From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the latest installment of the Psych Health and Safety's podcast live panel events. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the regular podcast. This is now the fourth live panel that we run, and we've been blown away by the support of the Psych Health and Safety community. So thank you again for joining in today. And make sure you hang around till the end of the webinar today, because I'll be announcing the next live webinar in October, and it is an all-star panel again. I'll introduce all of the panelists that we have today, and we've got some superstars again today. But let me introduce our longtime friend of the podcast, Wade Needham from Fresh Country Farms. How are you doing, Wade?
Very good, Jason.
Now, where are you today, Wade?
At home in Sydney. Been home for a while. We'll continue to be home.
Yeah, but the vaccine rollout is gathering steam over there, hopefully.
Going very well, and I think everyone's looking forward to re-engaging with people they haven't seen in a while in the flesh. Yeah, and I think a few comparing long hair and other features that may have grown a little bit larger, like jean sizes and those sort of things.
Well, I did comment before we went on air about your hair, and definitely it's getting a bit longer. And yeah, look, the rest of the panelists today are all from Western Australia, where we all have our freedoms intact. So we are feeling for you guys in Victoria and New South Wales in particular with this lengthy lockdown that you're in. So like you say, hopefully the vaccine rollout's done quickly and you can get your freedoms back.
Looking forward to it.
Now, the topic today is moving beyond ROI to look at the social impact of psych health and safety. ESG is definitely on board agendas at the moment. And I guess I've heard that from a number of different sources. You know, when talking to clients, you know, they're really interested in the sustainability angle. And I did hear you talk about the sustainability angle and the role of health and safety professionals in this area, particularly in the S of ESG, at the OHS Leaders Summit earlier this year in Brisbane. Did you want to maybe give some context to that discussion, Wade?
Yeah, so from an ESG perspective, ESG is something that's in a long line of sort of social responsible investing. And so that this sort of came out well before the last sort of iteration of it, and sort of in the 70s when it was pioneered by a lot of groups that, you know, you can connect the dots between morals and money. And so, you know, in the 80s, a lot of social movements drove awareness of business's shortcoming, especially around the capital markets. And then sort of corporate social responsibility came about. So that became the sort of the shorthand used, you know, when the United Nations and other institutional investors really wanted to outline that due diligence had become more comprehensive than just the financial metrics and accounting standards. So ESG is just really the next iteration of that. And most people would be, you know, quite used to seeing things like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and ESG is really just, and you know, by the way, stands for environment, social, and governance. And so that this sort of process and this driving force of capital markets is really around understanding the impact that the business community, and in particular, both private equity and markets, capital markets, have on the environments in which we, you know, work, live, and play. And really, to me, this is, you know, a quite exciting development, largely because of the things that we're doing, that most of us go to work every day and we don't just get out of bed for the paycheck. It's actually the impact we generate and the value we create, not just for our employers, but it's actually the legacy we're leaving, you know, for our children and those in other parts of both the country and the world. So to me, this is the start of something that's probably catching up to what's already happened. It's iterating it and tweaking it. It's definitely not new, but I think also a lot of industries and market practices that once may have dominated are becoming unsustainable in the market. And that's both pleasing as well as scary to see for a lot of people, you know, that are on both sides of the coin.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating, this evolution. Like you say, you know, some of these principles have been around for a while, but just this, you know, rise in popularity of sustainability and ESG. We all hear about, you know, net zero emissions and, you know, the importance of strong governance principles. The S is often missing in the discussion when we're talking about ESG. But one of the things that we've spoken about regularly on the podcast is this idea of getting top management support for workplace mental health. And one of the things that we need to do in order to achieve that is to understand what are the board priorities. And so if shareholders are saying we expect that the companies that we invest in will have sustainable business practices, and then that drives, you know, market cap and, you know, the valuation of the business overall, then that is something that is going to appeal to boards. And that is a lever then that we have when we're trying to convince boards of why would we actually look after our people and incorporate a psychological health and safety approach.
Yeah, and there's probably two ways in which it's being driven at the moment. One is from institutional investors that, you know, who own, you know, have shares in large companies, and they're expecting reporting disclosures being to be made via ESG disclosure standards, and those are things like, you know, GRI, GRESB, you know, those types of reporting processes, but also common metrics that can be used across industry to benchmark and identify, you know, which businesses are more sustainable than their competitors within industry, so institutional investors can allocate capital. And so that's one way. And then there's this other type of ESG sort of analytics process, which happens in real time. And you've got these analytical firms which are providing, you know, real time updates on what's happening in the markets, and things like, you know, when major scandals happen, you know, this is flashed up, and there's an ESG score being derived based upon these algorithms that private companies are developing to support investors' decisions. So you have both what I would call long form disclosures, like from an annual process, and through the normal stock market disclosures, and then you have short form, which happens in between, which is all those things that may fall between the margins, because we know that what goes into the annual report sometimes isn't audited, and secondly is sometimes probably just showing you who was bad and who's just gotten better at reporting.
Yeah. So, definitely this idea of reporting, and I'm looking forward to getting Georgina in here as well and talking about how do we actually measure and then report on social impact. Just one thing I want to mention before we bring on Rob and Georgina is that the title of today is Beyond ROI. And the reason we've said that is that we've been trying to get top management support for sustainable business practices like psychological health and safety, like workplace mental health for some time. And there's been so many ROI reports done by the Big Four consulting firms, and the reports, you know, have ROI for workplace mental health initiatives ranging from anything like $2.30 per dollar spent, if you look at the PwC report, for example, from 2014, all the way up to even, you know, $9 for every dollar that you invest in workplace mental health as a return. But it doesn't matter how good the number is. I think, you know, Wade, even if it got up to $100 for every dollar that was spent, I still don't think that's going to make boards move and top management move. So we're looking for new levers. And I think because ESG and sustainability and social impact is high on the agenda of boards and top executives at the moment, I think this is a lever that we can pull. So we're going to really prosecute that today in today's podcast and webinar. Just to let you know, listeners, we're already, 8 minutes in. We've only got an hour that we're going to talk for as a bit of a roundtable discussion. And then we're going to open it up for Q&A. Throughout, feel free to drop your questions in the YouTube or LinkedIn chat. And Joelle is working behind the scenes today to feed us some of the juicy questions that we can answer either as we go today or, you know, particularly in the last 30 minutes that we've reserved specifically for Q&A. So, Wade, should I bring on the other panelists?
Definitely looking forward to it.
Okay, so let's add in Rob Kosova. He is the GM People Risk at QBE. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, Joseph. Hi, Wade. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for joining us today. Great to have someone of your caliber on the show today. This is the first time you've been on the Psych Health and Safety podcast to Wade's third time now. So, really, really great to have you on. And we have Georgina here, who's actually juggling parenting duties at the same time as being on a live panel. Talk about the super mum. Georgina Camp, CEO and founder at Huber Social. So welcome, Georgina. Yeah.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah, thank you. I've got my little personal assistant here, Arthur, so I'll throw him the tough questions, but no, thanks for understanding. And if there's any strange noises, it's him, not me, definitely.
Yeah, why didn't I think of that? I have a kid here and I'm looking on them.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, lovely. So, Nana's just arrived, so thank you.
Thanks. Oh, perfect. This is the great thing we've been talking about with Zoom these days. Like, people are just used to, you know, parents and people having real lives. It's not fantastic that we can see a bit of that today.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've spoken a little bit about it in the intro, Wade, about, you know, what is ESG and why are our boards, you know, interested in this at the moment. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
I think also this question is not run, as in it's not done. The standards that currently exist that can be reported on, that, you know, that are often termed ESG disclosure frameworks, like the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board's framework, like GRI, you know, in particular 403 for health and safety. These are standards that exist but are not universally adopted, first off, and then secondly, often don't contain the things that may be material to each business. So they're a starting point, they're a launch point, and they're a baseline, but this conversation has a long way to run, and the answer's not there for us. And I think these types of discussions today help frame what's the next iteration going to be, and the audience, you know, that is going to listen to something like this will start that conversation in their own organisations to go, okay, we have these types of things to look at, to report on, to keep current investors happy, but investors are insatiable in their need to identify another indicator, something else that's going to give them an edge and show, and that link between sustainable performance and share price and good returns on capital for our investors. So I please don't think, you know, we can just give you the answers here. We can definitely give you some pointers. And I think Georgina is going to have some really good narrative to tell around, you know, where she was and when she first started her business to where it is now. So I think the exciting part is it's growing, and the people that are on this event are starting to listen and are part of that conversation. So don't feel like you're on the sidelines here. You're in the middle, and we need your help.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, on that, Georgina, tell us a bit about yourself and why you founded Huber Social.
Certainly, Jason. So I'm CEO and one of the three co-founders of Huber Social. And why we founded it is, I guess personally, my background was first military and also the law. And after lots of soul searching, whilst I loved working, particularly at the time it was the army, I recognised it was sort of the wrong end of problem solving for me. Whilst it's necessary, I wanted to be part of solving problems at the root cause before we needed the intervention of the military and the law. And so then I somewhat naively went to the other end and ended up in development and studied my master's development and worked with NGOs locally and internationally, and was pretty quickly heartbroken that that didn't hold the answers to solving social issues either. And I was very fortunate at the time to be working with two gentlemen who are now my two co-founders, so my two bosses, who taught me systems thinking, and in particular how to measure within that system to know it's on track. And we came together because we were really aligned on the sort of work we wanted to do and our values, so really using our powers for good and helping social organisations be more effective at solving social problems. And as we investigated that problem, what it boiled down to is so often the work that really matters to help people be in the best position to thrive or to actually solve the social issues isn't measured. And so that's how Huber Social came to be. We developed a unique measurement system to answer that. Oh, Jason, you're on mute, sorry.
No better than that button now, right? It's yeah, no, thanks, Georgina. And Wade's given us, I guess, a broader definition of what ESG is and, you know, why boards are interested in this. Let's get into the social impact side, right? So can you tell us more about social impact and how that fits in with that ESG framework?
Certainly. I probably see them both as on a bit of a spectrum and coming from different angles, and there's a lot of overlap in the middle. So ESG is looking at those three factors, environmental, social, governance, for their impact in terms of financial performance primarily. However, in that endeavour, they do some good. And I guess social impact comes from another angle where it's really what's the contribution, broader contribution to solving social issues. And depending on your approach, they'll cross over more or less. But one's really focused on solving social issues and the other on creating sustainable financial return.
It looks like baby's coming to the room. We might kick over to Wade and Rob.
Return. Yeah, and it's a useful point because I think the origins are important because, you know, whilst you are measuring something, it really is it's important to understand the bias that goes into both the measurement process but what the data is going to be used for. And I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday about ESG, and there was this discussion around, is ESG or the social impact a good indicator of future performance of how many people may get injured by an organisation moving forward? Can you use it to reliably predict the future performance? And we had this discussion around, well, is it actually used for that, or is it a static metric around looking at the impact of what you've done in the past? And is that it, has that got any projection into the future? And so there's often both how the frameworks are created and who creates them, who audits them, and then secondly is around who are the users of that data. So I don't believe, you know, if you currently have to look at, take for instance GRI 403, you know, which is a health and safety standard, you know, yes, it's written to, you know, to be, it could be audited by an accounting standard, you know, similar to the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board standards. However, you know, there is a lot of information that goes into creating those reporting metrics and some detailed understanding and narrative. So these processes to come up with both metrics and the impact of what is being created needs to be understood, because there needs to be trust behind that data and people need to accept it at face value. And I think so the important things is we acknowledge where they come from, the biases that go into why we're measuring them, but that does not take away the fact that capital markets can have a hell of a lot of good. And this is what I hope will continue into the future, rather than just, you know, potential greenwashing or loss of trust in ESG or sustainability wave that's currently, you know, through the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe you had a question for Rob based on your relationship with QBE Wade as well.
Yeah, so I think the important thing for me is that, you know, we, you know, Rob and myself know each other. You know, we've utilised QBE's insurance services, but one of the good things that we did, you know, when I was head of safety for Serco was something called Premiums for Good. So we looked for partners that understood what social impact was and their role within not just financial markets and not just in a transaction, but actually what value they were creating through their services. So there was some lovely overlap between those things that we were able to do, and Rob led that effort to actually Premiums for Good being utilized within the workers' compensation line. So I don't know, Rob, if you want to have a chat around those types of things that you're doing at QBE.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne. I think there was a comment in the comments I saw about, you know, 75% employees, you know, kind of have changed, I guess, the equation and what they expect from their organisation. So I think, you know, it's one of the things that drew me to QBE is that organisations are going to be doing more than just their day job. Obviously, you've got to have some values alignment. You've got to be looking to solve problems. And the bigger your scale, almost the bigger the obligation that is. And so I think QBE had been doing a bit of that internal navel gazing and talking about our company purpose. Our company purpose is to give people the confidence to achieve their ambitions. You know, we know all organisations and all people really, you know, want to leave the world in a better place. So, yeah, we just challenge ourselves. And one of the great ideas that came out of, you know, one of the, we call these hackathons where you can have just a bunch of brainstorming that happens around the business. And someone just came up with the idea that, we obviously generate a lot of investment income, you know, when people pay their premiums, you know, we seek to invest that and that sort of helps us mitigate, you know, some of the costs of doing business and tries to help us stabilize premium rates. Now, someone just came up with a great idea. What about if we created a separate investment vehicle that still allowed us to invest and still allowed us to sort of get investment returns so that we can keep our kind of premium rates as low as we can? But what about if we use that to invest just in ESG specifically targeted vehicles, and so it's been running now for a number of years. Our target is to have $2 billion worth of premium set aside that we would ordinarily invest anyway, but instead we're looking to invest those in, like I said, sort of investment vehicles linked to ESG sort of impacts. And That's, I suppose, where we started the discussions with Serco. We were talking to Serco about what are your ambitions. It's a lot about obviously dealing with vulnerable customers, young people, people that might be on the road to sort of incarceration or otherwise. So how do you kind of stop and get ahead of those problems? We fast forwarded that conversation three or four years later now. We're actually, kind of talking to Serco about a social impact bond that they're looking to strike up with the New South Wales government around trying to help young Indigenous youths find and stay in employment with a really simple idea of if you can help them get a driver's license, they can get to their interviews and then they can drive them to work every day rather than trying to sort of do other things with their time. And we're looking as a business to sort of invest in that potentially as one of the social impact bonds that we invest in. And there's lots of those conversations happening around the globe, and we're looking to invest about $2 billion by sort of 2025, which is, pretty huge for a business that just does insurance, actually.
And I think that's one of the things that when, you are considering insurance solutions for your business, that those types of things, to sort of quote Georgina, they don't come in the financial consideration. They're one of those things that you're having and you're having the discussion with it. If you know your customer well and what they want, with a growing impact upon, ESG on boards, that proposition becomes a hell of a lot more attractive. But also just, from the other side of things, the innovation that gets done in relation to, making sure that injured people through the line of work can get back to work as well in a quick and timely manner, having the gold standard of treatment at each stage of their treatment journey, I think that's really important as well. And so that was the driver as to why we wanted to do work and continue to have a relationship with QBE, but it was those additional factors around that creating social impact in the community with stakeholders that we had in common, that was really important to continuing and driving the relationship and bringing senior stakeholders together. So it's not also something that can be just done and finished. It's something that continues and is ongoing. So I think that's the other important thing to realise is that this is not a tick in the box exercise. This has to be done, and we continue to have to move and get better as new information comes about. So I think that the other innovation that QBE sponsored, that we partnered with, that we continue to do work with, is really important. And that's critical to, their customers, which come under social impact, because it's our injured employees.
Yeah, I think my sort of experience is that the link is sort of being made, and the conversations are definitely happening in the boardroom about ESG, and organisations are trying to understand how they can actually demonstrate to their people that they're living the value and not just sort of printing it on a letterhead. So I think there are practitioners out there, and we'll have a number on this call, and I know through my experience Wade is one, who are really successful at linking those two things. What is a really practical example of how we're doing, but how do I tie that back to, helping the organisation actually demonstrate how it's living its kind of ESG mantra? And I think it's happening. I think opportunities to share what's working well will allow that to snowball. And we'll see a significant advantage to those organisations that not just say it, but obviously do it and then sort of live those values and ingrain it in their culture. And we are seeing it. There are organisations that genuinely do this that have moved past the ROI, but I think there's a bit of an art at the moment. I think what we're saying is we want to turn into a bit of a science and give people a bit more of a roadmap to kind of be able to do that in a structured way.
Agreed. Yeah, well, I think it's especially in relation to when you are getting people back to work. Typically, the number that most return to work injury management insurance or safety people look at is return to work rates, or they look at, days lost and those types of things. I often don't think we actually have the right conversation when actually we should be considering, when we are getting people back to work faster from either work or non-work related areas, we need to talk about things like years lived without a disability, or what is the attributable burden we've avoided by getting that person back to work quicker. How many years of life have we saved by, taking hazards and risks out of the workplace? So I think there's a nice overlap between attributable burden to disease, which is measured from a public health perspective, which data is at a population level and readily available. And I think the next iteration for probably safety, health, and metrics in the workplace is taking things like pre-employment data or medical assessments data and starting to look at how healthy are our workforce populations, and is what we're doing having both an acute prevention of injury within the workplace, but also longitudinally, are we reducing things like chronic disease, where one in two Australians have a chronic disease? Are our employees in that one in two, and what are we doing to take it out? Acknowledging that we have a vested interest as them as a stakeholder, but also, you know, those as an individual have a vested interest in themselves as well as the community as well.
I think for once, Wade, the internet in WA is actually better than Sydney by the looks of it. we did.
I know. I asked everyone else in the state to stay off the internet tonight. We've only got one line that we all share. So, yeah.
That's right. Hey, Rob.
Stay in the cave.
I think someone in the audience picked up on the fact that you're investing $2 billion, not personally, obviously, but as a business, in sustainable ventures.
Yeah, I did see that question. And look, probably the best thing, I can put a little link, but we've if you just do QBE premiums number four, good sort of Google search, there's a page where, like I said, we're really kind of proud of it. It's won some awards in terms of innovation, and really all we're doing is taking actually our customers' premium income and spending it, we think, in a way that they would like us to, investing it in a way we think they would like us to invest. So it's just all we're trying to do is align values, which when you think back, it sounds so simple. And yet I think, you know, the recognition is that we're still one of the few insurers that kind of has a program like this. We're really proud of it. And it'd be fantastic if it was more broadly done, because again, the more funds you can have targeted at a problem, the more people you can think having talking about it. Yeah, the more change you can create. So I'll put a link in, or Jason, however you want me to do that. But Google search can do that too.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. This will come out as a podcast episode this Thursday, so we'll put a link in the show notes for that.
Great. Well.
Yeah, terrific. I think we can bring Georgina back in safely. She's got her headphones back on. She still has bub in tow. Well done, Super Mum. You are doing a great job there. I can see you in the background, making sure that he's keeping quiet. Look, one of the things that Wade started talking about was potentially, you know, how do you demonstrate that you are having social impact or you are looking after your people, and started to talk about some of the measures. I'd love to get your thoughts on this, Georgina, but I've got this, you know, interesting view on things. Maybe it's popular view, maybe it's, you know, somewhat controversial, but there's a lot of wellbeing and mental health work going on in workplaces. And a lot of the investment is on things like resilience programs. It's on things like, you know, corporate retreats or, you know, yoga or gym memberships and that sort of thing. And I don't know, like from my perspective, if that would really classify as social impact. What I see as social impact from an employer's perspective is actually creating healthy conditions where people can thrive, and thinking about the work conditions in particular, not the benefits necessarily that they're throwing at it. So it's actually, I see companies not necessarily reducing demands on workers, but trying to deal with the increasing demands and change and other burdens by just throwing more, you know, perks at people. And I don't necessarily think that that's going to meet the need in terms of social impact. But maybe you can, being this is your area of expertise, maybe you can weigh in on this. And, you know, how do companies measure social impact if they are doing it properly?
Certainly. Well, I guess recognizing social impact is defined as like the material impact on human well-being. You therefore, when you come to measuring social impact, want to measure the contribution to well-being. And of course, there's many different approaches to do that. But how we certainly recognize that, and how traditional, I guess, employee well-being metrics fit into it, is that they have a place as, I guess, one input into an overall position of well-being. So first of all, to measure impact in terms of well-being, we measure people's subjective well-being. But then you want to understand, what does a person need to be in the best position to achieve well-being. And so at that point, we look at what is their level of capability, but what's also their access to opportunity. And under measuring capabilities, you're certainly looking at mental wellness factors. So I guess every program has its focus, but it's important not to just measure the target outcomes that you're hoping to achieve, but take a more holistic approach to understanding the needs of people to essentially check that they are the right target outcomes to achieve the impact that you want to have. And you're right, Jason, I guess we, through some of the measurement we've done, we've noticed that some of those more superficial things, quick fixes, band-aids, don't really have certainly a lasting effect on people's well-being. And what we do is we apply statistics to identify the priority needs of people, and that's more often around things like connection and relationship factors and things like that. So that then helps employers have a much more targeted investment approach to look at, okay, as opposed to just fruit boxes and lunchtime yoga, what can we actually do to facilitate these more genuine mental wellness initiatives, I guess.
Yeah. I'm interested because with the ICD-11 coming out next year, they're bringing out a new definition, or refining the definition for burnout, and really focusing on the fact that it's an occupational phenomenon caused by unmitigated work stress. And so throwing, some wellbeing initiatives at things, is it really addressing, I guess, the root cause of work-related stress? Is it actually going to be effective in preventing burnout? And I don't know. So would companies be better off, rather than measuring subjective well-being, or in addition to measuring subjective well-being, would they also benefit from measuring burnout or emotional exhaustion?
That's great. You wouldn't want to be measuring at that point. You're already measuring too late if you're measuring burnout. I think you want to identify what is the situation that's leading. So what are the levers that you can pull before you get people at a point of burnout, and be measuring them. So when they are, they're evident, then you know to act. So it would be too late. But certainly I think you want to measure subjective well-being as that overall measure of impact, but then also understand what is driving that.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing when it comes to subjective well-being. I mean, we're talking about a range of influences on that, whether that's individual factors, lifestyle choices, genetic predisposition. Then there's the workplace factors, as you say, that could be driving that. And then there's macro events like poor weight in lockdown for, months and months on end in isolation, and global instability around financial markets and whatnot. So there's a lot of things that contribute to that. And I guess from a sustainability perspective, we're more interested in what are the things that the employer can control. So they can't control necessarily the fact that someone's marriage is falling apart, or that they're behind on their mortgage payments. But maybe they can think about the level of workload that people have, or the other job demands, or lack of autonomy, or lack of support, and that sort of thing that maybe they have as well. Is there ways, when we take a psych health and safety approach and look at psychosocial and risk assessment, we can measure some of those things, but I guess that wouldn't really necessarily be submitted in a report to shareholders, for instance.
No, and that's one of the challenges, Jason, is that, under GRI 403 and NSASB and those types of reporting standards, is that currently largely it's total recordable injury frequency rates. And we're back where we were probably in the 90s. So, whilst it's great that we're getting, investment level focus on this area, unfortunately, that's the most robust data we have. And that, I suppose, says something for us as an industry, where it's a starting point. It's definitely not the end, but it's the amount of, energy we're going to have to expel to push it past that point, and to be able to report on that. So currently, 403, for GRI 403, the indicators of how you identify, measure, and manage risk are very narrative in base. So when you report upon those, you're disclosing how you do it, not how many you have, not how much risk you've reduced, all that really material information that I know is happening in business day after day, but is being, I wouldn't say the word cherry picked, but is being reported favorably in those types of reports. So to be fair, you know, exactly as Georgina said, you know, once you're measuring burnout rates, it's exactly the point when unfortunately, you know, you're speaking to someone from an insurer and we've got those, you know, insurance stats at that point, the claim frequencies. So I think the hard part for us will be taking, you know, exactly like Georgina said, is that sometimes you've got the end in mind or you've got the intervention you've picked, but it's not actually the intervention that people need. And that's the challenge, is understanding either individual or segments of your employee base, what they need, consulting with them, setting up a workplace for success to thrive, and having both an individual team and organizational mindset. And that's really challenging for command and control organizations that are very hierarchical based and aren't employee first. We're not employee first.
I was going to say on that way, one of the obligations that we sort of take quite seriously is our ability to try and ask those kinds of questions of our customers. So I look after our people risk business, which is the kind of statutory workers' comp insurance. So in the markets we operate, we might have between sort of 20% and 30% of organisations sort of in that state. And so actually asking those types of maturity-based questions, trying to understand where our customers are on that journey. And then Georgina used a term that I've been using internally. That's to try and use our powers for good. So sure, we can, you know, we can always default to kind of a premium rate to try and drive behaviour, but we can also try and educate and sort of try and influence and make people aware. And so we sort of have this loose notion that customers will sit somewhere on a risk maturity continuum between kind of immature, they don't know what they don't know genuinely, and you know, if we just sort of teach them and tell them, they're sort of willing to come along. And then look, some know and just don't care, and that's the reality of the large business, but they're a minority really. So we've got a great ability to sort of educate and bring people along, give them the framework. So we've got a bunch of people in the middle, organizations that are maturing. They sort of know what they don't know but don't know where to start. Maybe they've tried and failed before. Maybe they've had a safety manager that was just really terrible at drawing the link, and so they've kind of given up. Maybe they went out and bought bowls of fruit and thought that would work, and all of a sudden, they still had the same absence rate. So we have a lot of hope for those, and then it's just about us trying to connect those that have the credibility and the ability, like Uber Social, into our customer base and try and sort of help those that are maturing. Then you get the really mature ones, like I said, that are kind of doing it. They've got investment teams and ESG teams. They don't necessarily always get it right, because there's always a difference between what you say on paper and what you do as part of your kind of culture. And there's some sort of mining companies based in Western Australia that have some recent experience about doing some things that are probably inconsistent with their ESG promises when you sort of forget to live your culture. But I think we all can really sort of influence organisations on an individual level. Lots of people talking about their examples I've seen in the comments about what they've done, if they consult to other organisations or sort of things they do. I think we've got a great power to collectively mature people along their risk maturity journey. Organisations don't intentionally want to hurt and maim people. They don't intentionally want to suffer poor productivity. They don't want to intentionally go out of business. There's a conversation that's sort of, you know, I guess needs to take place, and there's a translation that needs to happen, I think, between safety and traditional safety metrics and numbers, and then making them much more easy for, you know, executives and board members to kind of understand and sort of really translate it in the language, because they're not going to learn the other language. It's sort of up to us subject matter experts to actually convert it into their language.
Yeah, I'm with you, Robert. I think largely there is, know, maybe ignorance of, you know, that the fact that companies can take a systemic approach to improve workplace mental health. The popular things are out there, they're well marketed, and, you know, people focus on those, you know, nice to haves, and they don't realize, well, actually what people really need is just reasonable job demands and a boss that gives a damn, you know. That's, you know,
well, I sometimes old stuff is still good stuff. So World Health Organization, you know, it was sort of in the 2000s, wrote a paper about workplace stress, and you know, and they said the role of the organisation is to not just have an absence of negative health impacts, but have an abundance of, you know, positive health impact. And I just, it's such a simple way still of describing an obligation that an employer has, that, you know, just removing, you know, kind of a trip hazard, it's kind of not enough. You know, you've got to have an abundance of health promoting things. And then they did some other work, and there was some work on psychosocial hazards, and there were 10 psychosocial hazards. There was a paper, if anyone's interested, Lecker and Jane were the authors. And they, you know, there's 10 organisational factors, and it's all the traditional stuff, whether it's 10 or it's 6. And it's like, okay, well, if it's not just okay to work on an absence, I actually need health promotion stuff. Help me, you know, what are they? Okay, there's 10 or there's 6, whatever framework there is. But it's you know, it's a really simple recipe. Now, I think sometimes it gets overcomplicated, you know, I guess, around what organisations need to do, what they need to focus on, and sometimes there's a bit of disbelief that actually if you just focus on those 10 things, the results will take care of themselves. You know, you don't have to try so hard on those other kind of wellness retreats and campaigns, and they're kind of nice and they're great to add some diversity to your offering, but focus on an abundance of stuff. What's the stuff you can control? It's work demands, it's scheduling, it's task rotations, it's information, it's relationship with your, you know, your direct leader. Might not be cool, but those sort of foundational things are still, you know, the building blocks.
Yeah, what seems to be cool at the moment, Rob, is giving everyone a week off. So on LinkedIn, Nike's come out recently. And Joelle's laughing. I can see in the backstage. She wrote a post on LinkedIn that was quite scathing of this, calling it virtue signaling, basically, and not really dealing with systemic issues.
Oh, it's a social status, you know. It's kind of it's something kind of cool to show, because you know, you can't drive around the latest car, but you can kind of talk to people about your sort of your latest something that you have, you know, and it given an identity, and we kind of call it something. But we sort of describe this. There's no point delivering again a box of fruit on a Friday if on a Monday people come to work, excuse the French, but you know, the boss calls them an asshole. Like, there's just, it's inconsistent and just disingenuous, and it's impossible that it's ever going to work. So I think just, you know, from our, I guess, trying to provide a bit of confidence from our point of view as an insurer in this space, that, you know, these are the questions absolutely that we try and ask and understand of our customer base, not to sort of judge them, but just to understand where we can look to support them and help them along that journey, because it unlocks amazing productivity for an organisation. You know, when you think of the employees that are engaged, feel respected, their voices are heard, they're innovative, they're delivering amazing customer service, that's a great place for an organisation to be. But they just don't realise it, because they sort of haven't, you know, like we said, they've always had a conversation about strict ROE or LTI or safety-related stats.
Yeah, I'd love to throw back to Georgina, now that Bob's kind of calmed down a little bit and she looks chill.
I think I have that effect on people. I do put them to sleep, even babies, even my own children.
I don't believe that for a minute. But when we talk about measuring social impact, you talked about some of the various things you could do. Could you give us maybe a case study of, you know, maybe a company that you've worked with to help them to measure the social impact they're having?
Certainly. Well, I've got two from these two great gentlemen on the call as well, actually. So one via negotiated through Wade, I guess, with his old hat on. And that was looking at exactly the situation you were talking about before, where it was looking at, I guess, sure, we've chosen an intervention, and this was at a correctional facility in Queensland. And we have a program that we can see is doing a lot of good, but one we want to check, is it actually doing the good that we think it's doing? Or is there, understand the needs of the inmates, actually, in terms of what they need to truly transform? Would our money be better spent elsewhere? But if it is successful, then we want to have the stats on that so we can scale that as a solution across other facilities. So this was, it's called the Pups in Prison program. It's an animal inmates program. And what that program was measured to show was, yes, it overall improved a shift in wellbeing for the inmates and achieved a whole lot of great target outcomes, like improving their social skills, their empathy, their self-belief. But then also in terms of business metrics, there was a measured decrease in instances of aggressive and violent behaviour. So you could see how taking a broader picture to well-being, you can actually maximise your business outcomes when measured alongside each other. So I think that's a really fantastic case study. And then over to Rob, and we don't have the results yet, but I think it just speaks to what the maturity that Rob has been explaining with QBE, that they're investing again in a preventative program for staff across different correctional facilities to make sure they don't get to that point of burnout or psychological injury. So, and testing one that program works, but taking that more holistic approach to understanding what are the needs of the people in the program. So, they're two really great case studies. And Rob, I've actually, before I forget, I'll have to send you some information because we measured a great program, just like the bond that you're investing in over in New Zealand, where it was about to essentially decrease juvenile incarceration rates. They focus on getting youth a driver's license. And it was chosen to be that program because that's kind of the greatest lever, but they know that actually these youths have a whole range of needs. And through measuring holistically, it showed the program works, but also this is what you should invest in to maximise that return. So I'd love to share that case study with you to help set that bond up for success as well. So,
well, that's a great example of storytelling that I think it's really powerful. If we can take a story like that and then, you know, we can reflect that in our business and try and share that with our customers, people respond so much better to that. And, I don't think any of us are saying there's not a lot of great work happening, but I think it's now just trying to turn that into a bit more pointed influence sort of stuff. And I just, I know, from our perspective, we support a lot of customers and try and help them with their initiatives, but we do ourselves a disservice if we don't capture the broader ROI, even just saying, well, it's reduced your premium rate by 20%. That's great, but that's a pretty shallow view on what that work has done, because we're talking about the removal of harm from an ecosystem. And, that's so much broader than just the bill someone pays on a letter. It's about people going home and functioning and being proactive members of society. And even those, I've seen some comments again about, people maybe with diagnosed or undiagnosed ADHD. So it's about those that maybe have a condition already still being able to reach those higher orders of fulfillment, like that kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that they still should be able to be contributing members of society. And it's only if we tell those stories will that start to become true.
It also raises up an important concept of what's called materiality. And that's something that, before anyone goes into any form of ESG journey, you need to understand what's material from an investor standpoint that they understand that's important to them. But it's also very important for you to understand what's material to your internal stakeholders and the community in which you service and you're a part of. And I think that the beauty that we're slowly seeing is that for once, at the start, there was really around materiality of what it was too one-sided and wasn't material on both sides. So, the example of what Georgina gave around pups in prison, you had a hunch. It sounded good. There was good indications, but, we weren't measuring both sides of the coin. We were doing ourselves a disservice. And so, that had a positive byproduct of risk reduction. Now, that was important to me. That was my drive from a pure functional standpoint, but there was other stakeholders involved. And the more stakeholders' needs are met, the more material the impact we're creating, but also the more material is the area in which we should be investing in. And so that's the other, the large piece of inclusivity here is around, not only as a business do you need to take your employees on the journey and your different functions, but you need to take your supply chain and the community in which you operate in, not just your investors. And so that's the important part here is to reduce your environmental impact. Follow me, printing is not going to, it's not really going to cut the mustard anymore. No, great that you're doing it, but it's not going to make your front page. And if it is, you're not understanding those needs, and they move over time and they become harder and higher depending on, you know, how progressive we either are in climatic scenarios or other type scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested in exploring regarding, again, if we talk about social impact, obviously that can mean a range of things, but particularly we're focusing on the psych health and safety angle today, right? I'm interested regarding a question from one of the listeners today about the state of wellbeing. And he's asking, does mental health have to get worse before organisations are actually going to take action? Do we think it's gotten to a worse enough state? I mean, if I was to quote statistics from the labour force survey in the UK, for example, in the reporting period pre-pandemic, out of 38.8 million days lost due to non-fatal illnesses and injuries, 46%, 17.9 million days lost due to work-related stress, depression and anxiety. Can it get much worse? And does it have to get any worse before companies start to put this on their agenda at the board level?
So if you looked at materiality, the hard part with employees is that they can be replaced. Yes, there are transaction costs and turnover rates indicate that, and that's often reported on, absenteeism being another indicator. But until labour rates and until labour markets tighten to the point in which companies are unable to meet their contractual commitments to clients, it may continue to get steadily worse until there's a tipping point. That's horrible. But the positive thing of this pandemic is that labour mobility has been severely constricted, especially in Australia. So my hope, but my also worry, is that right now we're seeing the peak and as labour shortages crunch and labour mobility continues to tighten, I think the penny has dropped and retention is hugely important and labour scarcity is really going to be the final nail in the coffin that will make people realise that this is really important. And that's probably number two topic at most boards that I'm part of and involved with after the pandemic impacts.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are starting to vote with their feet, they're saying. So it's not just investors, who are interested in sustainability and social impact. It's also, you know, people when they're choosing where they're going to work, continue to work where they are, or when they're looking for their next job, they're looking for, you know, the working conditions. And as I read in an article just recently, it's not all about table tennis tables anymore and, you know, gourmet food being available, but it's like, what are the working conditions and what's my boss going to be like?
I also think, Jason, we're coming back to where we began, that the ROI reports have done a huge disservice to that, because essentially what Wade's saying is until it costs us too much, we won't change. And with the ROI reports, they just focus on the good that's achieved. They're not measuring holistically to show you the true win, the full wins, but the full cost as well. So you need to look at the net effects of that. And I imagine that would expose that it is costing us more than we realise, and particularly for sustainable business outcomes. And I wish it was different. I wish people would put wellbeing first. But ultimately, we have to work with the system till we can change the system. So therefore, the power is in the measurement. And if we can measure the true cost of ignoring that, then we might be able to change decisions and change the system. So
I love how there's a task force for climatic related financial disclosures, TCFD. There is now a task force on nature related financial disclosures. Where's the task force on human employee related financial disclosures? That's what we need.
It's sad that we still put them separately, because it's part of one system and they're interrelated. So for any outcome to be sustainable, we shouldn't have them separate. So, but anyway, that's a whole nother podcast.
We'll have to have you on again on your own, Georgina, and Joelle and I can extract that out of you.
I was just going to add something, Jason. There was a question in the chat from Michelle about an actual case study, which Georgina mentioned, but I think this is, you know, this is the point for me, I think, and this is why we as a I guess as an insurance company, it's about trying to provide, you know, find a kind of like and build an ecosystem of like-minded people, and collectively we can try and take everyone on that journey. You know, I'm not the expert on what to measure in terms of an ESG, but Georgina is fortunately, and Uber Social is. So I can tell the first part of this, but the second part is sort of important. And as I said, this particular example, it's a large customer. They operate sort of prisons and correction services centres. And there was a theory that if you can train team leaders and managers to listen and sort of be in tune and care more, I guess, for shortcutting the purpose of the program, if you can get them to care more about their people will feel more cared for, and then they'll probably perform better. That was the simple basis of the hypothesis. And so that the pilot was done, and individually people's sentiment was high. So I feel better. Great, fantastic. But again, if we stop there, we're doing a disservice. Same amount of money invested in the pilot, but what happens if we just lift that thinking a bit and say, well, that can't possibly be the only impact that we've just had with that. So that person then goes home and they're tackling a teenager that's had a difficult day, and they're in a good headspace. You know, how do they then pay that care forward, and, you know, and how do they interact with society? Maybe they go and do some volunteer days. Like it can't possibly be just that intervention is all we've done. You know, otherwise that's not getting me out of bed in the morning. There's got to be a broader purpose. And so without knowing what the answer to that question is, we then, you know, I guess scan the horizon to sort of see who could help us understand what measures we should be measuring pre and post intervention, and then roll up that into a case study that is just so impactful that people find it hard to ignore that. And we're talking, and another comment was, it's not just risk and safety people, it's CFOs and CEOs. Everyone has a what's in it for them, and we've got to be able to canvas all of those in the case studies. If you just appeal to one audience and it reduced this by that and it increased that by Y, we've sort of missed influencing 10 other stakeholders with the one case study. So in that example, it's what has that program done? Because just making someone feel better, while it is good, and we think it's, you know, a good thing, that can't be all that we're doing with it. And so I think any organisation has the ability to do that, whether it's a specific intervention around psychosocial health or something else. Don't just think about it again in terms of the ROI and sort of be constrained into thinking that we just need to just think about this person and this project and this ROI. It's about the sum of the harm when we talk about that's been removed from the system because of the intervention. And that harm can have different consequences. It can hurt a person one day, it can hurt a customer the next day. That harm could lead to a catastrophic environmental spill. It doesn't necessarily matter what the harm is. We just got to think about the various harms and be able to measure them.
Yeah, I love how you're connecting it to the community impact, Rob. You know, employers have to be aware that if their people are hurt, and not just physically hurt, but, you know, mentally hurt, and so develop, say, disorder like anxiety and depression, doesn't just affect their productivity and the bottom line of the organisation, but when they go home to their families, those relationships are going to be hurt. Their ability to contribute to their communities, you know, is going to be hurt as well. And so, like you say, we need to understand the extent of harm outside of the workplace, but we also need to understand the extent of good. Got something on the back burner. We really want to push this out at some point, which is a community impact assessment, or a pay it forward index, we're calling it. So when you run a wellbeing campaign in the workplace, not just looking at the, you know, the smiley face, you know, kind of positive feedback you got about the campaign and using that as measurement, but how did it actually improve wellbeing of your employees, but also the people that they went and paid it forward to in their communities, how much did it actually affect their wellbeing? And there's, so that's something that we're really excited about. Like, how do you measure that community impact, which is far greater than just the employee impact.
And Jason, sometimes employers can the environment they provide for employees, the income, the purpose, the social connection, that can help overcome or improve the social determinants of health. And I think that's another thing where a lot of health and safety personnel and people within organisations don't have strong literature around the public health side of the business and the impact they create. So in effect, we're so focused on preventing that acute injury, we're not looking up and out. And so it's a different language. And yet, so we have to learn those public health messages, the public health determinants, to bring that back in to know what good we're having, like what Rob's saying. But then secondly, then we have to translate that back into, you know, financial speak for our investors and those around the table who only have that set of language. So in effect, you know, people like Georgina that are almost sense makers of understanding and facilitating conversations that we don't have the language to be able to have. But it's important to start the discussion and acknowledge that you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, you put your hubris and ego aside and ask.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we are just on the 1 hour mark. Is there anything else in our agenda, that planned agenda, before we get to live Q&A, Wade, that you wanted to cover off?
To be fair, I always forget about the agenda. I'm always so wrapped up in the conversation and reactions and those types of things. But to be fair, if there's any remaining time, I'd love to give it to Georgina, because I mean, appreciate you are juggling. So yeah, I'm sure there's a bit more you'd like to get out.
And there is a question there at the end of the agenda for Georgina, which she hasn't answered yet, which I'd love her to answer on, actually. There's a lot of people here that are interested in social impact. That's why they've attended the webinar today, and they want to hear from you. You've spoken a bit about measurement of social impact, but how does someone get started? You know, where do they start if they're actually interested in measuring social impact? If you can unmute yourself, Georgina. Glad it wasn't just me.
Sorry. thank you. So regardless of what approach you're going to use, the very first social impact intervention is to understand theory of change. People might know it as an impact thesis, but essentially it's your hypothesis. So how do you think you're going to create the change? And then you measure and test that, just like any kind of scientific evaluation. And the approaches can get more sophisticated from there. But there's, I guess, different principles that you want to apply. So you start to get started, definitely just start with your theory of change and then the metrics to know how you're going to measure that you're achieving that and test it. And if you're not measuring impact in terms of overall well-being and you're only focused on these, the outcomes we want to achieve, and measuring them, then you won't have the ability to test whether they're actually the right outcomes for the people you're working with.
How do you go about selecting what are the right outcomes? Because there's various things that we look at. Right? Like
sure.
It might be EAP usage when it comes to mental health. It might be, you know, it pays off.
So probably your outputs. They're what your outcomes would deliver in terms of outputs. They're your more tangible things, your measured activities, I guess. And your outcomes are what's are necessary to contribute to that overall impact of well-being. So it would be things like, it could be anything from self-purpose, resilience, etc. And then you'll see the outputs fall out of that. How do you know what are your right outcomes? Well, in an ideal world, if you're starting from a blank canvas, you do exactly what you're suggesting, Jason, and do like a community needs assessment or an employee needs assessment. And that will tell you, depending on what approach you use, the priority needs within that, and then you can design your program. Otherwise, how we do it with programs that are existing, we first understand what are your target outcomes. Let's definitely measure them. Are they being achieved? But then we cast the net again and say, for the people you're working with or impacting, what else might be their needs? And you essentially can select off a big shopping list of human needs and build your measurement scope from that. Then you measure and learn, okay, actually, are our target outcomes spot on? Or should we pivot slightly? Or have we identified an opportunity to partner with someone else and together meet these needs more holistically, which is sort of the ideal way to work as well. So.
Yeah, you've got a follow-up question, Wade.
What was that?
Yeah.
You look like you got a follow-up question for Georgina.
Oh, it's a good point, because there's employers often think that they have to do everything themselves, and there's this concept of what's the employee's needs, what can I do to help, where's the line do I draw, duties of care, you know, lawyers get involved, you know, personal opinions. But there's some really good examples that, that I've seen around, you know, individuals who may be, you know, on the lower pay spectrum, you know, from the national employment standards, you know, where they fall behind in you know, payments that they have. And so companies connect with, you know, low-doc loan providers and you know, enable those types of, you know, stops people dropping into payday lending and those types of things. So that you don't have to do it all yourself. You know, financial well-being is as much social well-being and mental well-being. And so they have a byproduct. So I think the interesting thing that Georgina said that I always pick up on every time I listen to her is that you don't have to be the smartest person in the room. You can follow on what other people are doing, and it's about connecting and following and standing on the shoulders of others who have tried, done again, because like Rob said, it's no longer an art. It's a science, and that's the stuff that should be reported upon, passed on, reported on, and scaled and made bigger through social impact bonds and other types of scalable means. I can't remember, Georgina, you can probably tell me who's the financial provider that does do those. I think it's Samaritan something. I remember speaking to them once in a prior life, but I can't remember who they are, but they're the ones that prevent people dropping into payday lending and those types of destructive cycles.
I'm not sure. Sorry, I'm not sure. I'll have to take that on notice.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to put Georgina on the spot again because recently there was an article that came out about some research that looked into employee training on resilience and well-being. And the researchers found it actually had no effect on actually improving the well-being of participants because they said, well, look, companies aren't dealing with the systemic factors. And as we've said a lot on this podcast, you know, you can practice all the mindfulness that you want, but if you're having to work 14 hours a day every day and your boss is a prick, it's going to be pretty hard to like maintain a good level of well-being. So you've got to deal with those things first. One thing that they did find actually effective, the only thing out of the things that they measured that did seem to have a positive impact on well-being was actually around community kind of volunteering. So helping out at a soup kitchen or that sort of thing, which has always been part of my philosophy. And I think you've alluded to this a bit, Georgina, as well. You know, when people, and Rob as well, when talking about aligning values and doing something meaningful where you feel like you're doing something that's going to improve the quality of life of others and not just focus on yourself and self-care, that does, you know, from my belief, seem to have a better impact on well-being long-term than just these sugar hits of like, you know, a little bit of mindfulness here or a yoga session here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have another client. It's not published yet, so I can't steal too much from it or borrow, and I want to be able to give them credit. But they've invested in doing a job seeker wellbeing index across Australia. And what that has revealed is no matter the demographic background of job seekers, there are top five priority needs are consistent for all job seekers. And I wish I had them in front of me, but I do remember that one of them is absolutely purpose, and another one was self-belief as well. So that's not only important to understand to meet the needs of our job seekers, but also what they're looking for out of employment. And so I think it was just such fascinating work because it revealed what really matters to people isn't necessarily finding highly paid job, but finding purpose and meaning in their work and having a sense of purpose and having self-belief. And then what was really fascinating is beyond those top five, by the different demographic groups, the priority needs start to diverge. And when you look at the youth job seekers and female job seekers, actually, one priority need that was consistent for both was connection to land and place, which that really just speaks to, I guess, for the youth, I would infer that's that understanding that, you know, they want genuine impact and they want to understand that and work for employers that are mindful of that and report on that. Certainly I think it's not, they're not looking for superficial gains. That's not what matters. And the data's starting to show that, so.
Yeah, so it's about, you know, as Wade has alluded to as well, you got to meet people's basic financial needs, but above that, then people really need that sense of connection with mission and purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, We've got about 20 minutes to go, so I'd love to take a couple of the questions from the audience. This one I'll bring up is delivering services, including environmental and social improvements, as part of local government deliverables. How do we get it as part of measures for internal community being employees? So would anyone like to have a go at that one, unpacking that question? It's a lot to take in, that question.
It is, because it's the divide between treating clients above internal stakeholders like employee groups, and it's about the weighting of materiality. And so you'll often see, as part of the materiality grids that most people have in there, either the sustainability, their sustainability reports will be matters that that impact them. And unfortunately, external stakeholders, namely customers, typically are raised higher than internal stakeholders. And I think that's both an understanding of a business being a going concern. That's important. But secondly, it's just the state that, you know, we report on and we value people that continue to provide financial revenue to keep the business going, so it continues to operate. Now, that's quite paradoxical, because if we don't value our employees and keep them in our business, well, we can't generate revenue and undertake services.
Same paradox exists in healthcare pretty strongly. Yeah. Like, it's not uncommon, hospitals, aged care provider, you know, the care for the patient comes before the care of the individual. And, you know, it's always that adage, the kind of oxygen mask on the plane kind of stuff. Like, it is impossible to look after someone else if you don't look after yourself, you know, and your team and all those people that are responsible for that, delivering that service first, which, you know, I guess for me just comes down to that, the cultural maturity, their sort of risk maturity and how they view who they view as important and in what order they do that. And the less mature, well, they'll either not care or they'll get the order wrong. The more mature will get it and they'll get the order right and realise that you've got to sort of go in a bit of a chronological order. You can't look after stakeholders and customers unless your own staff are looked after first.
Yeah, funny, the healthcare example came to mind immediately, Rob, when Wade was talking there. Patient care, patient safety is so important. And we talk about how doctors and nurses are burning out at alarming rates at the moment. And you got to have to wonder, like, not only is that bad for those people, but the people they treat. And that's all part of the discussion today, right? How do we get psych health and safety on the board agenda? You got to align it with business outcomes that they're interested in. So if investors are saying that, you know, sustainability is important, then that's one of the levers. But looking at other outcomes that the business values, like patient safety, you know, then that's another lever that you potentially have at your disposal.
Yeah, and sometimes it's, you know, the climatic disclosures and reporting are well advanced, rather than the social, you know, they're a little bit more less mature. So the other thing as well is you can piggyback on how those environmental measures were identified and through the materiality process, and that gives validation to what you're placing before your executives and your board as to what's material and why you're reporting upon it and who should care. So I think that's really important to understand, you know, what makes up materiality, and then that shows that you understand the financial mindset that resources are finite and you have to place resources where you can have the most material impact to your stakeholders. Now, if you're a function of health and safety, of course, that's your internal employees. So, you know, good management of your resources towards the most material areas of impacts that you can have reported on as such, you know, is the way in which I think we can get not past the CEO, but, you know, into and having a more diverse group of stakeholders to include investors as part of our conversation and to understand their demands. Because often what a lot of people don't understand is when they hear institutional investors, they think faceless people. They think large corporations and pension funds, and those institutional investors have members that contribute their superannuation or their pension, and, you know, or a future fund or something like that. So they're real people. And that's the reason which is really driving a lot of this impact and understanding and responsible investment, is that, you know, if it's no good having a very large return on a pension fund if you can't use it at the end when you're able to draw upon it.
Yeah, and that's what you were saying before, Rob, right, with your Premiums for Good program. You've got that amount that you're going to be investing up until 2025, and it's really aligning the values of your investors with where you put your money in the programs that you invest in.
Yeah, it is. Yep. And look, you can be sure if we don't, you know, think like that and challenge ourselves to act like that, then others will. And, you know, the customers that think and act like that will gravitate towards them and they'll get a competitive advantage, and we don't. So there's an altruistic reason, but there's also, coming back to that, you know, language, you've got to be able to explain it back to, you know, a CFO or someone else too. And it has a cold hard edge to it as well.
Yeah. I've got another question to bring up from the audience. So this one is, we're all businesses and heavily investing in the best interest of employees and business for wellbeing, mental health. Where do we draw the line between how much we can support as a business? Anyone want to take that one on?
The interesting thing is that this question, if you answer it now or in a year's time or a year before, will change. So community expectations really drives a lot of this, and where the legislative sphere is at. I mean, there's currently a couple of executives in both, you know, Korea, Japan and France for, you know, up on, you know, industrial manslaughter charges for overworking people. I'm sure there'll be a prosecution in the next 5 years, you know, against a director or an officer who an employee died by suicide. So the interesting part is that this question right now, whatever the answer will be out of date in future time periods. And I think that's, you need to acknowledge that the things that you do now has an impact into the future, but also whatever you do now will have both a positive, not just a negative and be out of date, it'll have a positive impact into the future and have a compounding effect. Because if you can keep people in the thriving headspace, they'll continue to have positive social impact for their own families and communities and the others that they interact with, namely their director reports and further employees. So I think it's hard. The pandemic's blurred lines even further. But I would always say, if you think the line is there, go a little bit more.
Yeah. I was actually having a really interesting conversation with a occupational hygienist from Canada last night, our time. And we're having this discussion around exposure limits and confidence intervals. And basically, if he wasn't able to get enough sampling data to work out the risk, then he would add on an extra 10% in terms of the overall risk that was present. And so, like you say, you know, maybe adding on an extra kind of element of unknown risk, you know, and then deciding on what your action should be, going, well, if we don't understand the issue well enough, we have to consider this as a higher risk rather than a lower risk.
You throw some contingency in there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and that ties into the next question that came through around leaders don't know how, it's not part of their development process, but I guarantee you all directors and officers understand reputational risk, right? If you can couch it in those terms and translate it through, the lines are easier to understand if you're using a shared language. And so finance is one shared language, reputational risk is another. And so, you know, you may understand an event, but you may have to bring in two or three other people that can then make that risk real and help you translate. So it might be Georgina, you know, for one conversation, it may be someone from your media department for another. But I guarantee you know, Rob mentioned before those, a major minor that was having troubles in this area. You know, no business takes a decision, which, you know, from what my understanding was, they took a legal decision, a legal action. However, it was well outside of community expectations.
Yeah, Dr. Rebecca McCallack, who appeared early on our podcast series, she talked about an example where a company lost $2 billion off their market cap because there was sexual harassment, and the perpetrator was actually promoted rather than, you know, reprimanded, or, you know, there was no punitive action taken. In fact, he was promoted. So investors will be scathing for companies that don't look after their people and manage these hazards appropriately.
So maybe the issue of whilst we don't want to burden people, we can extend their learning of what they are on whatever path they're on by placing our concepts into their language and working with people who can straddle the divide. And so that's why I think the other thing is that, you know, it's great having people like Rob on as part of this conversation, and Georgina, and it's not just about, you know, health and safety functions waving the flag. You've got other stakeholders that can support you if you're sitting in a business looking at, you know, who my allies are to get this conversation flowing. It's around talking to your broker, talking to your insurer, talking to people that can advise you on your measurement processes to make them more robust so that they can be included in annual reports, starting learning about, you know, principles of responsible investment, understanding if you're a public company or not. Those are all variables that you need to get after and have a look at, tie back, but have conversations with other people. You're not first, and you won't be the last.
Yeah. Hey, wait, just very quickly, I wanted to come back to that community expectation driving, you know, how much effort we put into certain things. So if you think about it today, you know, how much asbestos would, you know, the public think would be acceptable for employees to be exposed to in the workplace? All right, how many fatalities when we build a bridge, you know, should we, you know, think is enough to accept, right? So you're dead right. We're going to see that change and evolve over time. And I think it's only going to be more of a responsibility they're going to put on employers to have sustainable working practices to support the mental health of employees rather than less.
Yeah, and I think here's another one. If you don't ask your insurer what your last 5 years of workers' comp stats looks like, and you're not weighting that data with where you need to invest your money and not talking to someone who can give you reliable information as to how to prevent those outcomes, and you're not providing competent advice, and you're a health and safety person, you're not on very good footing from either a professional perspective nor a competent side of things. So to me, there's an obligation upon individuals, professions to step up the game, reach out. It's not a sign of weakness. And you have to lead this conversation because you get paid to make decisions and advise people who make decisions to provide them good advice.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Rob, there was a question that came out directly for you. You mentioned about having individual power. Did you want to expand your thoughts regarding that?
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I saw that, and I think it was obviously where I was talking about the ability for us to influence organisations and individuals in organisations from immature to maturing to a mature kind of mindset or culture. Because even in mature organisations, again, large mining organisation will use that, there are individuals in there that had an immature mindset in a mature organisation. So that can kind of happen anywhere. So I think the point I was trying to make is that every conversation we have, we've got to be trying to influence, you know, people to change their understanding around what's required, that it is the organisational factors that are the backbone of this. You know, it is those things. We're not talking about investing more. We're talking about more smartly investing the existing capital. So if you have a bunch of people turning up every day, you overwork them, you don't talk to them, you don't respect their input, that's a really shitty way of running a business. And, you know, there's only a couple of consequences out of that. You're going to be less productive and you're going to be less competitive. And you're going to have higher turnover and less engagement and loyalty. So if we know that to be true, we just need to be rephrasing the conversations around well-being, resilience, and that it's really important to have those all the other bells and whistles, but the fundamentals still aren't being done right in a lot of organisations. So I think we've just got an obligation to try and, you know, kind of influence the change, be willing to change the message based on how the listener kind of might want to hear it. And that's sort of, we talked a bit about translating the message and also thinking more broadly and rolling the impact up. So thinking about it more broadly than just, you know, mental health. There was, as we were talking about, there are these eight, and there's probably more, but anyway, I've got a framework of eight. There are sort of eight risk assessment biases. And we're talking about an individual's perception of risk here when we talk about someone not wanting to change or not wanting to listen about mental health or not wanting to invest in stuff. There are eight biases, and it's important to understand which of the eight biases our listener might be having. A really simple one is, you know, immediate threats get all the glory and the long-term ones don't. The personified versus anonymous as well. So anything that people are personally experiencing, you know, I want to invest in this because I really... So I think we've just got to use the flip side of that as we start communicating this and really try and find a way of articulating the impact of the long-term, because people find it hard to quantify. They focus on the short, and then try and make it really personal, you know, around this. And, you know, how would you feel? What if it was your, you know, your daughter, your son, your sister, your wife, you know, because there's a another comment earlier about, you know, do we sort of really want to go around asking everyone how they are? You know, I guess two things I'd probably say. One, don't if you're not willing to listen, but if you are, then do ask. And I'm an employee and I love it, and I would love it if my employer asked me how I was feeling. That feeling doesn't stop when you get to a particular level of an organisation, and it shouldn't. Now, it does in some, but again, that's about their maturity and how they think. And we got to, you know, people are nudgeable, and we just got to find a way to nudge them.
It takes a while too. You're not going to be successful overnight at just changing things in your business. I mean, I don't know how long Georgina and I spoke about, schemed and understood and found use cases and all that, because it was the right methodology. I just had to find the right use case and the right leader who was willing to take the personal risk, find the right person who I want to do good to start it and do a pilot. And you know, I'm sure Georgina is a hell of a lot more interested in what you're doing now than what there was 3 years ago. But you know, you got to start, don't you? And I'm sure you help a lot of people have those conversations to convince as to why it's valid, which I think is you know, the aim of this podcast, Jason. So I think we're all having these conversations. It's about linking up and compounding and doing good.
Yep, absolutely. I'm really interested to hear, Rob, that like the regulators, the insurers are getting involved on the education part, right? So it's not just about, you know, premiums and, you know, trying to influence that way. But it's, hey, look, there's a lot of ignorance out there. So if we can educate people, we fundamentally believe they want the best for their employees, right? They want sustainable business practices. They understand the benefits of that, but they just don't understand that maybe the sexy, well-marketed stuff isn't the best route. And what we really need to look at is taking a risk framework.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and again, stuff that's well promoted and publicly spoken about, like resilience training, will catch people's focus and they'll bias their kind of risk control selection based on that. So we just got to be kind of aware of that and I guess encounter it with some information. I think in terms of QB's place, we two kind of catchphrases we use, we've got to use our powers for good, you know, genuinely. We've got a very privileged position to be really connected with a lot of employers, and we want to try and use that for sort of positive impact and try and identify global solutions to local problems. It's not up to me or QBE to come up with a solution. It's just try and find like-minded people and for us to all connect and then, you know, create our sort of, you know, area of influence and just sort of expand that outwards over a period of time, and it will take time.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic that you've connected with Georgina. I am conscious that we're getting towards the end here, Georgina. Was there anything that you wanted to contribute to finish us up?
I guess just picking up on a lot of what's been said is we certainly found at the beginning that it was more the brave CEOs that would work with us that were prepared to be wrong. But then where they were, and it's never wrong what you're investing in, it might just be we've identified an opportunity to maximise what you're doing and stop wasting your money. But we've had, I guess, different reactions to results sometimes where some people are like, well, not some people, we've had one client maybe we reject that, I don't think you're measuring the right stuff, to, oh, okay, that's really interesting, what we're doing isn't the priority need. And instead of going, can we just report the good stuff, going back to the investors and saying, you know, what we're doing, we're only going to hit this limit in terms of impact. But if we pivot or if we partner with this person, we can then have this impact. And showing that accountability is such a much more powerful place than just like going with what the current sexy kind of metrics are or sexy initiatives are. I think it's just that reframing, seeing it as an opportunity, not seeing it as doing something wrong. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a pleasure to work with people like Wade and with Rob. I mean, insurance is the business of well-being, so they're really prepared to invest and get it right, because the better off people are, then the better off the business is. So it's a beautiful alignment of the two outcomes. But I think ultimately all businesses will benefit from having that point of view too. So.
Yeah, and then there's the greater societal impacts as well when companies do the right thing by their employees. So,
yeah.
Awesome. Well, Georgina, I'm going to let you go off and be a mum. You've done a fantastic, I think all of the people who have actually been viewing this live will just be completely amazed at how on point you've been and how you've been able to focus on the conversation despite having to parent pretty heavily over the last hour and a half.
Poor Arthur, he's like an expert at pitching Huber nowadays. But no, thank you for covering me when it wasn't going so well in the background here, but and being such gracious host. So thank you very much and good evening, everyone. Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks, Georgina. And thank you, Rob, for coming on. It's been a pleasure hosting you as well.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jason. Great to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, terrific. Well, I'll say goodbye to Georgina and we'll put Wade back in. Wade, thank you very much. I mean, I don't think I mentioned it at the outset, but you're instrumental in pulling the four-star panel together. So Rob and Georgina talked about the importance of connection. So it's great how you've found these people who are really like-minded and really trying to create an impact in this area in the right way.
And the more people that want to have this conversation, happy to share like those connections, but also thoughts. But also if someone has other thoughts that they can, you know, that they've had or those sort of things, you know, the discussion is richer when you share. A lot of people just look at social media, LinkedIn especially. Be brave, comment, send a message, say something that what you think. And people who have a thirst and want to know more and want to learn will always, you know, show you the right side of the cheek and will acknowledge your contribution.
Yeah. Talking about people who love to say what they think, we've got Joelle who's giggling in the background. She did cause a bit of controversy, I think, calling out Nike on their 1 week off without necessarily promoting any of the systemic changes they're making, if any, to support their workforce. So, Wade, myself and Joelle and Rob and Georgina too, no doubt, are pretty active on LinkedIn. So like Wade said, please connect with us. We want to continue the conversation. We want to connect with like-minded people and, you know, collaborate and make this change together. So thanks, Wade. We'll be chatting again soon, no doubt.
Beautiful. Thanks, guys. Enjoy.
So that brings us to the end of the latest live panel, everyone. Thank you for everyone who joined us live. Thank you to all who maybe tuned into the podcast later and listened to all 90 minutes of it. So thank you for joining us in an important discussion around social impact and the role of psych health and safety in that. And moving on beyond that, obviously, to the discussion of measurement, as Georgina was able to provide her expert opinion and input on as well. Just as a quick shout out with our next event, so that will be in October. We will be welcoming back Desi Vlahos from the Leo Cusson Center for Law. She was on an earlier podcast talking about the impacts of workplace mental health in the legal profession. And I think you'll agree it's a real all-star panel featuring the likes of Lucy Brogdon, who's a National Mental Health Commissioner here in Australia. We've got George Artley, who's from the International Bar Association, Fiona McLee and Dr. Michelle Sharp joining us as well from Australia. So a real all-star panel, and we'll really and actually my job is going to be really easy that night, as is Joelle's, because Desi will be moderating. We'll be keeping out of their way, but it'll be a really fascinating discussion on the 12th of October regarding the current state of mental health in the legal profession and what needs to change. But that brings us to the end of today's episode. Everyone, remember, you'll be able to catch the podcast on Thursday this week on the Psych Health and Safety podcast. You'll also be able to catch this video immediately afterwards on the Flourish DX YouTube channel as well. Thanks again to everyone who participated, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.